From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. One of the country's largest fuel pipelines remains shut down after a cyber attack on Friday. Colonial Pipeline said it was the victim of a ransomware attack by a criminal group, though it has declined to say whether it paid that ransom. In the meantime, the Georgia-based company says it will restore service to several smaller lines. The shutdown has so far had little effect on gas supplies and prices, but that could change because the pipeline provides nearly half of the East Coast's gas, diesel, and jet fuel. And let's bring in Mike Chappell. He's a cybersecurity expert and information technology professor at Notre Dame. Mike, welcome.
Thanks, Tanya. It's good to be with you.
Yes, so many of the details are still unknown. We do know that Colonial Pipeline shut itself down after this ransomware attack. How are you thinking about this, given the limited information? What do you think is going on here?
So what it looks like, Tanya, is really a run-of-the-mill ransomware attack. If you look at the few facts that have come out, what it appears is that they were just a target of opportunity. And the fact that they fell victim to sort of a run-of-the-mill attack that, you know, everyday businesses fall victim to says that maybe their cybersecurity wasn't up to snuff.
Okay, the FBI has confirmed the culprit is DarkSide, a criminal group. This is a non-state entity. What does that say to you?
It's that same concern that we have an organization that maybe might not be that sophisticated and was just searching around the internet for an organization that they could penetrate with this ransomware and stumbled across Colonial Pipeline rather than maybe necessarily having a targeted attack. Because when we're looking at something like pipeline infrastructure, these are companies that really need to understand the nature of what they're running, and the systems involved in controlling this type of critical infrastructure should never be directly connected to the internet.
On that note, this I know is a simplistic question, but why is a pipeline even vulnerable to a digital assault?
Well, if you look at the pipelines and other types of infrastructure, everything like that today is digitally controlled, whether it's computer systems that are running it or other types of electronic hardware that are just sending the command signals up and down to open valves and control the flow of gas. Everything's digital these days. Standard practice would be to put all of those types of systems on their own isolated network so that they can't be directly attacked. And we'll have to see as the details come out on this attack whether the attackers were actually able to get into those systems or maybe they only got into some systems located back in the offices.
Hmm. You alluded to this, but we've seen a few of these kinds of attacks recently. Last year's attack at the software company SolarWinds hit several U.S. agencies. President Biden responded with an executive order boosting cybersecurity standards. There are new questions about possibly issuing another executive order. How is the administration handling these concerns?
Yeah, so there are rumors in Washington that an executive order is imminent and is likely to come out this week, irregardless of this attack. I think this obviously puts a new focus and spotlight on that. That order is expected to target only the activities of federal government agencies and their contractors. So it's likely that it wouldn't even cover a company like Colonial Pipeline. So I think what the administration is doing right now is important and necessary, but it's not sufficient to protect some of these critical infrastructure targets.
You see that as a flaw. What are you asking the administration to look at?
I do. I think what we really need to do is look at this as a holistic problem, and it needs to be a public-private partnership. We need government agencies and private companies who are responsible for running these critical infrastructure systems to work together. And, you know, we've tried sort of soft partnerships in the past. I think what this is really going to need is a combination of regulations and incentives, and frankly, requiring that these companies that are operating pieces of our infrastructure meet certain security guidelines and verify that they're doing that to avoid this type of attack. You know, there are a couple of other things that the administration is talking about. One of them is the creation of an independent board to investigate cybersecurity incidents modeled after the National Transportation Safety Board. I think that would be an excellent measure because it would not only provide an independent review of these incidents, but it would allow everyone to learn from them. So not just the company that was attacked, but everyone else operating in the same space. And you know, this is the model that's worked very well for the NTSB for a long time now. I think that would work well in this space. And then the other piece that's missing is that we do not at this time have a national data breach notification law. So there's no requirement for a company like Colonial Pipeline to necessarily report every cybersecurity incident that happens to them. Mm. So there's a lot that has to happen around visibility, but I think we are going to need that combination of regulation and incentives to make all of this happen.
Mike Chappell is a cybersecurity expert and information technology professor at Notre Dame. Mike, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tanya.
Well, as we've been reporting, the supply of COVID-19 vaccine is starting to outstrip demand in some places around the country. North Carolina, Arkansas, Connecticut, and South Carolina have cut back on new deliveries because they have more doses than they can use. And the average number of new doses administered has fallen almost 50% since the peak in mid-April. Let's bring in Derek Thompson. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic. Hey, Derek, welcome back.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And you've been writing about the vaccination slowdown. You point out that it started on April 13th. That's the day the FDA recommended a pause on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Do you see a connection?
I think if you're wondering about the timing of the decline in vaccinations, it is awfully curious and coincidental that this decline started on the very day that U.S. health officials warned about the Johnson & Johnson vaccines. By the way, they recommended a pause, then 10 days later they said that they thought that given the risks of the virus itself, that it was probably worth taking the vaccine for most people. So yeah, I do see a connection, especially in terms of the timing. The bigger question, though, is why vaccinations continue to plummet. They didn't just fall for a week or 2 weeks. You know, they've fallen for about a month. You know, it's May 10th right now, so that's about a month after the April 13 decline. So I do think that something else might be going on here.
Before we move on to that, I just want to stick with this J&J storyline for a minute. Even though the risk of getting a blood clot after taking that vaccine is very low, do you think that some people did get a message that it was somehow dangerous?
Yeah, I do, for two reasons. First, looking at the data, and second, listening to the anecdotes. So first, if you look at the data, if you look at a graph of vaccinations per day in this country, the decline literally starts on the very day that the FDA and CDC recommended a pause. So it does seem like the timing has to be related to the Johnson & Johnson shots. And then there's the anecdotes. Across the country, health clinics have said that there's a lot of patients who were uniquely excited about the one-shot regimen of Johnson & Johnson. Maybe they were afraid of needles, or they were concerned about mRNA technology. For whatever reason, they were into the J&J shots, and a lot of that enthusiasm seems to have evaporated when the CDC and FDA recommended the pause.
You write that there is a difference in vaccine supply and demand depending on whether you live in a traditionally red state or a blue state. Explain what's going on there.
Well, one thing that we've seen in the polling going back several months is that the single variable that most predicts whether you are pro-vaccine or vaccine skeptical, vaccine hesitant, it's not education, it's not ethnicity, it's politics. Democrats have always been more eager to get these shots than Republicans. And right now, if you look at the 20 states where the daily rate of first doses is higher than the national average, all 20 of those states voted for Joe Biden in last year's election. Meanwhile, the 13 states where vaccination rates are not only below average, but also where fewer than half the population has a shot, so the places that are really falling behind, 12 of those 13 states, all but Georgia, voted for Trump in November. So you see both in the polling and in the real-world data that the most important dividing line when it comes to who's getting these shots and who's not getting these shots is politics.
And that's to your earlier point, that this, you know, that in particular had nothing to do, most likely, with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. That's just plain hesitancy.
That's right. I think there's a wall of vaccine hesitancy that we were going to hit in April or maybe in early May, no matter what. And I think in the big picture, this is what happened. The Johnson & Johnson vaccines surged into the market. They absorbed a lot of the low-hanging demand for shots. And when the FDA and CDC recommended a pause, the remaining population was a lot less keen to get the shot. So what happened is, first you had the Johnson & Johnson shots come out of the market. You saw a little bit of a decline. And then that decline kept going because all that low-hanging fruit of vaccine-eager Americans had been plucked. So right now we're dealing with a problem where demand is falling below supply. That's a problem we need to fix, and not only in persuasion in doctors' offices, but maybe in terms of policy, you know, giving people, right, you know, free beers, free cash for shots. I think that might be a really important policy going forward.
Well, let's talk about that, because now we're hearing public health officials say that essentially herd immunity may not be attainable at this rate. So what do you think of those efforts to get people to come out, to shed that hesitancy or that reluctancy? Is paying them the answer?
In the big picture, I think a lot of individuals are doing a cost-benefit analysis, a very personal cost-benefit analysis. They are weighing their feelings about the pandemic against their feelings about the shots. And one way to nudge a cost-benefit analysis is to up the benefits. Maybe that means getting people into bars so that they see vaccine shots as something that they can get with actual shots of whiskey or vodka. It seems less like a pharmaceutical invention and more just like a social interaction. Or maybe we should even start paying 16 to 35-year-olds to get vaccinated, like $100. That's what West Virginia is doing. I think we need to get creative here.
Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Two senators say they now have enough votes to pass a bill that would reform how the U.S. military handles sexual assault cases. Republican Senator Joni Ernst and the Democratic Senator Kristen Gillibrand say these reforms would take sexual assault cases out of the military chain of command and instead be handled by independent military prosecutors. For more on the current process, let's bring in Colonel Don Christensen. He's the former chief prosecutor for the Air Force and the president of Protect Our Defenders, a nonprofit dedicated to ending sexual assault and rape in the military. Colonel, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tanya.
Let's talk about the problem. Can you walk us through how the military currently handles cases of sexual assault? If someone comes forward and says they've been sexually assaulted, what comes next?
What happens next is, by law, that allegation has to be turned over to the investigative services in the military, so like Naval Criminal Investigative Services or the Office of Special Investigation. They do an investigation. Once that investigation is complete, they give it to a commander of the subject of the investigation, the suspect, and then that commander either makes a decision to start a criminal prosecution process or decides not to do anything. They do get advice from a lawyer, but ultimately the chain of command is the person who makes the prosecution decisions that in the civilian world are made by lawyers.
And this is a conflict of interest because a commanding officer then can know the perpetrator.
Yeah, the commanding officer will always know the perpetrator because they work directly for them. No matter how fair a commander is, they will have developed an opinion about the person that's under investigation. And that could be a good opinion or a bad opinion, but it's going to impact their decision-making. And that's why, you know, in the civilian world, we have people outside of the investigation who makes the decision whether to prosecute or not.
How has this gone on so long where there's obvious conflict of interest?
Well, the military has opposed any reform that would take away the authority of commanders to make prosecution decisions. And this is something that's been debated at least for the last 100 years about how appropriate it is for commanders to have this decision authority. And they have been successful up to this point at convincing enough members of Congress that it's critical that they and they alone have prosecution authority.
Well, according to the Department of Defense, only 7% of cases in 2019 actually resulted in a conviction. I mean, that is a pretty low rate, not to mention how many cases likely go unreported. Is this part of the systemic reason why the numbers are so low? And really, does conviction even mean the perpetrator will be removed from the military?
Yeah, it is part of the reason that it's so low, because we have people making decisions that aren't lawyers, aren't prosecutors, and don't have a full understanding of the law or sexual assault and the impacts of sexual assault on a witness. there's a lack of faith in the survivors who are sexually assaulted, that their case will be handled well by the chain of command, so they often don't come forward. When they do come forward, they often suffer retaliation. As a result, they will drop out of the process. And so when it's all said and done, a very small percentage of cases go to trial. And of the few that do go to trial, the military usually loses them.
Hmm. Well, as a former chief prosecutor for the Air Force, how important is it that the military bring in independent prosecutors?
It's critically important. Independent military prosecutors like myself, we've had years of experience dealing with sex assault crimes, talking to survivors, understanding what they've been going through and the challenges that brings to successfully prosecuting a case. A commander will never have that kind of experience. They have lots of other important jobs they do. And this is something that if we are ever going to get to a place where we have a better chance at justice, we have to do.
What else will the Military Justice Improvement and Increasing Prevention Act do?
Well, one of the most important things, for example, for Senator Ernst, is that it's also going to work on prevention side. And one of the things she's looking at is base security, more cameras to monitor what's going on in common areas. You know, we're really looking at two parts of this, the preventing anyone from committing a sex offense, but the accountability if they do, and marrying those two together is our best chance of driving down the numbers.
That's Colonel Don Christensen, former chief prosecutor for the U.S. Air Force and the president of Protect Our Defenders, a nonprofit aimed at ending sexual assault in the military. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
We want to share now one story of this problem in the military. Amy Marsh says she's a survivor of sexual assault by a member of the military. Her husband is part of the Air Force. She lived with him on Travis Air Force Base in California. And after an event with members of her husband's unit, Marsh says she was sexually assaulted by a high-ranking Air Force member who was supposed to be her husband's mentor. It took her months to report what she says happened to her, and she says Air Force leaders did little to help her. And Amy Marsh joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Amy, thank you for taking the time to share your story with us. I want to start first with your experience with reporting this crime, because we know from Colonel Christensen and others that many crimes, including rape and sexual assault, go unreported in the military. What was the process like? And did you have any understanding of the justice system beforehand?
I did not have any understanding of the justice system beforehand. To be completely honest, I didn't even really understand what sexual assault was when I thought that I had. The process was very difficult for me and my husband. People tend to focus on me because I was the victim, but we both were victims in this case. Yes, the actual incident had occurred to me, but to this day, he still has to go to work every day and relive the trauma that he had when he had realized who the assailant was. The assailant was someone who worked very closely to him, and he had really trusted this man with his life. Mm-hmm. And when this man had betrayed that trust, that destroyed any ability that my husband had to trust anybody. He vented and he confided in this man who had assaulted me. My husband did not know who the person was. I didn't tell my husband because I was afraid of the consequences that might come from that.
Colonel Christensen outlined the issues of having a commander specifically so involved in the process of an investigation. What ultimately happened in your case?
After the OSI investigation had been completed, the commander ultimately was their decision on what they were going to do. And the commander knew the assailant, who was a chief master sergeant who had 28 years of experience in the Air Force and had gained a reputation at that point. And the commander had also known me and my husband, who had maybe two years in the Air Force, who had not gained a reputation yet, and we were still learning. His liaison had told my SVC that he refused to bring me to court. And the next step in the military process was to go to his commander, which was the commander of the 18th Air Force at that time, and The 18th Air Force commander had also decided not to bring him to court-martial and only do administrative action. But the issue that I have with that is that neither of the commanders themselves took the time to explain to me, the victim, as to why they made these decisions. They had someone else explain this to me, and I never had a chance to ask them follow-up questions directly to that commander.
To say this has upended your life is kind of an understatement. You had to leave the state with your family. You've said before that your husband's career in the Air Force was ruined. How are you and your husband today, over 2 years since this assault? You mentioned that your husband is still struggling with this. How are you?
I have been healing. I've been doing intensive counseling, and our church has been phenomenal. And we have some mentors in our church who are retired chief master sergeants. So they understand the way the military works, and they understand what it's like to go through struggles similar to this. But my husband, I will say that he is having more issues than I am at this point because he has to live with it daily. Basically, it's been a living hell for us for the last 2 years. And up until 3 months ago, we've really felt like there's no hope at all for us or for future victims. I was not aware that there was a bill in Congress currently, this possibility that decisions such as these could be in the hands of people other than the commanders. It brings us so much hope knowing that my voice can actually make a difference for future victims.
I'm so sorry that this has happened to you and your family. What do you want members of Congress to know as they take on this proposal?
I would like them to listen to the stories of the actual victims. I would like them to know that this can really change the lives of people considering joining the armed forces. We have a 6-month-old baby right now, and if nothing changes, my husband and I are... We don't want my son to join the Air Force if things don't change. So if I had to speak to senators today, I would ask that they seriously consider this because this is a real thing that affects people's entire lives. For our personal situation, my husband would have been a phenomenal squadron commander, just the way he's wired. But he will never have that opportunity because of our decision to do the right thing and to report the sexual assault that had happened.
Amy, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you for having me.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
More homeowners are behind on their mortgages than at any time since the Great Recession. That's according to a new report from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And while the housing market is still hot, rising interest rates mean the mortgage market is cooling off. And let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, CBS News analyst and host of Jill on Money for the latest. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So the CFPB says the situation isn't quite as bad as the 2008 mortgage crisis because of COVID-related forbearance programs that started with the CARES Act. How is that relief helping?
Well, I'm just glad you brought up the crisis in 2008 and 2009 because the government did a really rotten job of helping homeowners who were underwater at that time. And I think the lessons were learned very clearly. And so the CARES Act, as well as new efforts, were able to give people a lifeline. And that lifeline really meant that anyone who had a federal loan or a federally backed loan was able to go into forbearance, which essentially is like a timeout, that the mortgage company can't come and bug you for payments. You don't have to pay. Yes, there is interest that could be accruing, and each mortgage company might have something slightly different, but it was a real breath of fresh air and a real collective sigh of relief among those folks who were really scared they were going to either lose their jobs, lose hours, and get under pressure throughout the pandemic recession.
I want to ask you about something else, Jill. Black and Hispanic homeowners are twice as likely to be behind on their mortgage payments compared to white borrowers. This is according to the CFPB report that looked at 662,000 mortgage loans. Can you explain what's happening?
Well, we have talked about this in the past, and that is that Black and Hispanic workers have been disproportionately and negatively impacted by the COVID recession. They have been in occupations that have forced them either on the sidelines or, frankly, they had to take huge risks. And what's happened to this, to these two groups in particular, as well as a lot of low-wage workers and younger workers, is that they really suffered much more dramatically than the overall population. So if you look at the number of Blacks and Hispanics that were in loan forbearance, you know, or delinquent, they are 33% of the, they account for 33% of loans in forbearance, 27% of the loans that are delinquent. But, you know, they only make up 18% of all mortgage balances. So again, they have been hit much harder than the rest of the general population.
Okay, I have a minute with you left, and I want to talk with you about something that is very frustrating for people who are looking for a home. Homes are being sold for thousands over the asking price. What are the largest implications of that tension in the market?
Well, okay, so here's what we know. We know that we came into this crisis with a housing shortage. The supply of homes had really dropped to low levels. Now it's at historic lows. Because there aren't enough homes for sale, prices have gone up. And now at the very moment where some people are actually getting back to work and maybe they could afford homes, we have interest rates starting to tick up some. What's very important for anyone looking for a home, run the numbers. Do not reach beyond your budget or you could find yourself in trouble in the future.
Good advice. That's Jill Schlesinger, CBS News analyst and host of Jill on Money. As always, thank you so much.
Great to be with you.
As U.S. troops start to come home from Afghanistan, the violence in that country only seems to be ramping up. On Saturday, at least 50 people died in an attack on a school in Kabul. Many of the victims were young girls. Americans who fought in Afghanistan over the course of nearly 20 years are watching these developments and weighing in on President Biden's plan to end the war. One of them is retired Staff Sergeant Travis Mills, who recently wrote a piece in USA Today supporting the president. Mills lost both arms and both legs in a bombing in Afghanistan in 2012, and he joins us now on Skype. Travis, welcome. It's good to speak with you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So make your case. Why is it time to end this war?
Well, you know, I just feel like after so many years, no one needs to avenge my injuries. No one needs to go over there and fight for anything besides for the person to the left and right. And honestly, we've done what we can. And I just feel like now is the time to pull out and let the Afghan nation stand on its own, have the help of NATO and our support, and, you know, strategically keep bases that we need. You know, Kandahar, Bagram, very well-placed places for NATO and us to use and be ready for anything that happens in the world. But in truth, you're not fighting a conventional war. So it's not World War II where someone's going to, you know, be defeated.
There's no way to win, in other words, that which is what you've written before, that there's just no way to win that war.
I mean, look, we win every day when we're over there. I've built schools, I've built wells, I've helped with building hospitals and things like that. And that's a win. But as far as the enemy, there's no clear defined enemy. I mean, the person that just shot at you hides their AK-47. They're the ones asking to come work on the forward operating base and build walls so they can get paid. I'm not going to say the Taliban beat us by any means, because, you know, if you look at the rates and things that we've done over there compared to, like, how many people, you know, we've been had to bring home in caskets compared to how many people they've had to bury, like, yeah, the numbers are staggering for them. But, you know, we've helped them realize education, fresh, clean drinking water, hospitals, infrastructure, and building their nation, you know, in that way to better their lives.
I hear what you're saying. I do hear what you're saying, but there is a pretty good chance if the Taliban resurges that all that work that you did building the schools where girls get to go and learn alongside boys, the wells and villages that you created, all of that could be just for naught. I mean, destroyed if the Taliban comes back. I mean, isn't that something that that you consider?
Well, absolutely it is. But we've also worked very hard. The last probably 6 to 10 years, I would say, it was – well, actually, when I was there, right? So when I was there 9 years ago, I got injured. So 9 years ago, we weren't the ones kicking doors in. We were not the ones starting the fights. It was the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police doing all that work. So we've trained the trainer. And, you know, I think they can do it, and I think they will always have our support. And let's just be honest. Technology nowadays, somebody in Las Vegas can be flying a drone and take out any, you know, Taliban camp or things like, you know, training camp that we find. So I'm not saying we're pulling out completely, but I'm not too worried about, you know, all of that happening all over again.
You referenced your injury, and so no doubt this is a very personal issue for you. Would you mind describing what happened 9 years ago last month?
Yeah, absolutely, no problem. I put my backpack down on top of a bomb accidentally, just like the ones that we were talking about, you know, going off this past weekend, and it took both arms, both legs from me. So I'm a quadruple amputee, you know, and I'm one of five to survive my injuries, very fortunate and lucky, and is, you know, bitter as you think I might be, or people would imagine, I'm really not. I got the chance to live through my injuries because my medics worked so hard. My wife and I, you know, were married 4 years when this happened. We had a 6-month-old little girl, and life goes on. Now I'm, you know, 9 years outside of my injury. I have my 9-year-old daughter now that helped me learn how to walk and everything when I first got injured. I have a 3-year-old son, and my wife Kelsey and I are celebrating our 13th year of marriage. And it all was made possible because my medics and the nurses and the doctors worked on me for so much, like 14 hours of surgery I went through. Now, am I Louis Zamperini from the movie Unbroken or the story Unbroken? No, I'll never forgive the Taliban. I'm not that guy. He's better than me. Let's just say that.
Yeah.
I'll never be the guy that goes over there and wants to shake their hand. I'll be the guy that's like, yeah, I still hate you, and that's okay. It's okay.
Mm. What you call the anniversary of that day you were injured, your alive day. I mean, do you feel like you should have died?
When I woke up in the hospital 4 days after I was injured, they medically sedated me, and I woke up in the hospital. You know, I was asking questions of myself, right? I ignored all the doctors and nurses, and I was like, am I a bad person? Does God hate me? Like, what did I do wrong in life? And the biggest thing I did ask, besides for how can I be a husband and a father, is why didn't I just die? You know, and I'm very fortunate to be friends with Gary Sinise, right? So Lieutenant Dan from Forrest Gump. Right. And you have that feeling, not that it's suicidal, not that you want to die, but it's like, how is this going to be better? I'm just going to be a burden. And I had no idea about the technology and the advancements that was out there in the world, right? Like, I have prosthetic legs. I have my prosthetic arm. I drive my truck like everybody else. I go do whatever I want. Been very successful because I live in the nation that takes care of me. I have a nonprofit, the Travis Mills Foundation. I have 4 businesses that I own and operate with some friends. And, you know, life goes on. But it is in the beginning stages of, well, what am I going to do now? Like, what kind of life do I have left to live?
Retired Army Staff Sergeant Travis Mills. We're going to link you to information about his foundation at hereandnow.org. Travis, thank you very much for speaking with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I hope I'm not heartless. I really feel that the Afghan National Police and the citizens have to stand. They have to rise above, and they have the capabilities, and they can do it. I know because I've seen it firsthand when I was in firefights with them, fighting right beside me. As vicious and ferocious as I was fighting, they were too. So they have the abilities, and I think it's going to get better.
Well, now to the pandemic. One of the first groups given the chance to get the coronavirus vaccine has also been one of the hardest to convince: police officers. In Chicago, numbers from the police show just over a quarter of the department has gotten a shot at city-run vaccination sites. The city says that number does not reflect officers who might have gotten the shots at other locations. But as Patrick Smith of member station WBEZ reports in this story that first aired on Weekend Edition, the trend is happening across the country.
On January 29th, Chicago Police Superintendent David Brown got his first shot of the COVID-19 vaccine.
It was painless. And I am afraid of needles, but I didn't feel a thing.
It was the start of the city's vaccination program for its police officers.
So I hope all of this is encouraging to all of our officers in CPD and our non-sworn staff to get the vaccine.
But 3 months later, data from the Chicago Police Department show that about 3,500 CPD members had received at least one COVID-19 vaccination shot. That's 27% of the total workforce. The city insists that number is artificially low because they aren't tracking officers who get vaccinated outside of city-run sites, like at pharmacies or hospitals. Dr. Robert Murphy, who heads Northwestern University's Institute for Global Health, says a low vaccination rate among Chicago police officers is
terrible for public health. They're traveling around between different neighborhoods within a district and sometimes between districts, plus meeting themselves in relatively close quarters in a police station and handling prisoners in very close proximity. All that leads to, you know, spreading infection.
Vaccine hesitancy has been a problem at law enforcement agencies across the country. In a survey of law enforcement officers conducted by the website Police One, just 38% of respondents said they would voluntarily take a vaccine. That's significantly lower than the general public. And the reluctance extends to corrections staff at jails and prisons as well. Andy Potter is a retired corrections officer and the founder of the national corrections advocacy group, One Voice United. He says COVID-19 has been devastating for people in his industry. Hundreds of police officers and corrections staff have been killed by the coronavirus, and many officers feel like they haven't been adequately protected by their own departments. But Potter says it shouldn't be surprising the vaccine rates are so low among officers.
You're trained from day one to have suspicion of everything. You're trained from day one and conditioned to have a level of mistrust. And now someone comes up and says, yeah, we got something here that might help you out.
In Chicago, police have reported more than 3,200 confirmed cases of COVID-19 among officers since the start of the pandemic. And some residents are outraged at the low vaccination rates. Jim Blissett lives on the south side of Chicago. He says he's scared that if he encounters Chicago police, one of them might expose him to the coronavirus. He says officers have a responsibility to keep themselves and others protected from the potentially deadly virus.
If you don't roll down your window when an officer approaches you, you might get shot. So you better be vaccinated if you're going to approach me and force me to have this less than 6 feet contact with you.
City officials say they do not have plans to mandate the vaccine for officers or other city employees. For NPR News, I'm Patrick Smith in Chicago.
We're waiting to hear what will happen to Medina Spirit's Kentucky Derby victory after a failed drug test. The horse's Hall of Fame trainer, Bob Baffert, has been suspended. Joe Drape covers horse racing for the New York Times, and he joins us now. And Joe, Medina Spirit's failed drug test comes after he won the Kentucky Derby on May 1st. What did the test find, and what happens now?
Basically, the Medina Spirit drug test showed an overage of a drug called bethesmone. Bethesmone is a corticosteroid that you basically inject in joints. It's an anti-inflammatory. It's there to get rid of the pain. And that's what it found in overage. We now wait for a split sample, and the split sample is simply another test that they pulled at the same time. The trainer, Bob Baffert, has the opportunity to send it to a different lab. If that lab confirms the first test, then Churchill Downs has come out and said Medina Spirit will be disqualified and will be given the first place award and $1.8 million first place check to the owners of Mandaloon, who was the runner-up.
This is very rare. This does not happen often.
If this indeed happens, it'll be only the third time that a horse has been disqualified in the 147-year history of the Kentucky Derby. 2 years ago, a horse named Maximum Security finished first, or at least crossed the finish line first, but was taken down after stewards determined that his rider had interfered with rivals as they turned for home. In 1968, a horse named Dancer's Image, it had a more similar circumstances to this. He won the Derby, and then 3 days later flunked a drug test, and he indeed was taken down.
If Medina Spirit is stripped of its title, will this change the bets that people won in betting on this horse for the Derby?
That's the million-dollar question. I got a bad answer for anybody who's holding tickets on Mandaloon. If you bet on Medina Spirit, if you bet on the horses that he beat and Mandaloon, who was right there with him, you lost that bet. So that money's not coming back to you.
Okay. Bob Baffert, the trainer, denies any wrongdoing. How is he defending himself?
He basically says it wasn't him. He didn't do it, that horse was never trained with that drug. And, you know, he has hinted that he thinks it may be a conspiracy or something happened to him untoward. That's his stance. But just to kind of put it in context, he has 30 violations over the course of his career for drugs and medication. He's had 5 in the last year. So I don't know if it's sloppiness. I have no idea what has happened over there. But his denials seem sort of strange in light of his recent history.
What are the consequences for him then? If he has all of these infractions in the past, how has he been allowed to continue in horse racing?
Tanya, great question. Horse racing has had lax regulation in the culture of drugs for decades, you know, almost 50, 70 years go back. The sort of moment we're in right now is there was a federal bill passed last year called the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act, which is going to put law and order into the sport. It's going to have meaningful rules implemented across all jurisdictions, and the drug testing will be run by USADA. And USADA is the one who tests our Olympians, and they were the ones who caught Lance Armstrong in cycling. Mm-hmm. So, you know, help is on its way, but right now they're in between the old world and implementing this new world.
So up next is the Preakness. What are the implications based on what happens in this case regarding the Derby?
You know, Bob Baffert said he has 2 colts, including Mandina Spirit, that he wants to run in Baltimore. The other is Concert Tour. Right now, the Maryland Jockey Club and the owners of Pimlico Racetrack have moved back entries a day till tomorrow at 4:00. So they're definitely thinking about banning him or not taking his entries or not allowing those colts to run. I think it's going to be a very difficult thing to uphold because, you know, then you're going to kick it to the court systems depending how badly Baffert and his owners want to run. So, you know, everybody's kind of waiting to see what word comes out of Baltimore.
I know you love this sport, Joe. Is it getting harder to love?
Tanya, it's definitely getting harder to love. I mean, I have looked at congressional testimony on these same issues from 70 years ago. I've sat in 3 hearings myself. There's always been a promise for reform and change, and it just never comes. And, you know, you juxtapose that to the history in our country. It's America's oldest sport. Who doesn't like the sight of a thoroughbred running at full flight? It's a beautiful thing to do. But they're kind of putting themselves out of business, not only with all these scandals about doping and drugs, but, you know, this is a different world. Animal rights activists do not like to see this, and I don't blame them. I think anybody who actually loves a thoroughbred and is steeped in the history of the sport doesn't like this. So maybe this federal bill will change it up, but there definitely needs to be a course correction and a culture reform.
Joe Drape covers horse racing for the New York Times. Joe, thank you so much.
Have a good day.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.